lots of connections in Genesis.
I know that. The connection where it comes from, that the servant shall eat the rest of the earth, and the fact that man created the serpent preying on man.
Well, I've said to the devil, just remember, dust shall be the serpent's meat, not this dust. So, there's a connection. The curse was not that Satan should prey on man. That's not what the curse was. So you can draw an application from it, but it's almost a crosswise application. So, in other words, the curse on the serpent was that the serpent should eat dust. And Satan isn't a snake, number one. But analogous to that, for a snake to be crawling in the dust and dirt is to be humbled, downtrodden, low. And so, for Satan in the spirit to, as it were, eat dust means that man is going to trample on him in the spirit. So the curse was that he'd be put under the foot of man. And as far as us being made of dust and him eating us, that's just something that's kind of crosswise, that, because that was a judgment on him. And a judgment on him isn't that he have victory on us. So you can draw those kind of crosswise applications, and they're more ironic than they are really intended, I think. So that's what I'd say about that. Chapter 10, the sun and the moon stood still. Verse 14, there was no day like that before it or after it, that the Lord hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. The five kings fled and hid themselves in a cave. The kings were killed for justice, and then they were hanged, usually by their hands, for example. And they were only hung up for one day, as an example. And this is according to the book of Deuteronomy. With verse 24, Joshua said to his generals, "Come near and put your feet upon the necks of these kings." They came near and put their feet upon the necks of them. Now that was them acting out in a typological figure, treading on your enemies. We read in Psalms 110, verse 1, "He must reign until he hath put all enemies under his feet." And the enemies under your feet is dominion. Joshua and his captains took dominion over these kings. Now, this was just a symbolic action. There's no virtue in putting your foot, dirty old foot, on somebody's head. And others might complain of cruelty and all this kind of thing. This was merely a symbolic thing to show that they had dominion over them. Now, in Romans 16:20, "The God of peace shall bruise Satan under your feet." Romans 16:20. He'll bruise him under our feet. Now, how can the God of peace bruise Satan under our feet? Well, when the war is won, there'll be peace. There is no peace in the middle of a war. Satan is warring with us. And in order to have peace, we must defeat him. Otherwise, we're going to continue in the war. Also, Luke 10:19, "You shall tread upon scorpions." Luke 10:19, tread upon them, have dominion over them, walk above them, upon them. Matthew 22:44, and James 4:1 and 1 Peter 2:11, our spiritual enemies that we're fighting. 1 Peter 2:11 and James 4:1. At the end of chapter 10, they took numerous minor cities here, and they're listed in chapter 12. I'm not going to read the rest of the chapter. There is some similarity here in chapter 10 to the Battle of Armageddon. There was an Antichrist here, a king of Jerusalem that led them in battle, type of the Antichrist. There was a uniting of various forces. And then Joshua and his men were called into battle. There were hailstones. The sun stood still. And there was great victory. There are particulars here that are somewhat analogous to the Battle of Armageddon. Then another question. On verse 12, the sun and the moon standing still. Here's an article I got. Computer proves Bible truth. And there is an alleged claim that in clocking the solar system and the heavens and so forth, there's a missing day. And all of this that I have ever read, I have read more than one article on this, all of this goes back to Mr. Harold Hill as the instigator of this idea, who evidently had some kind of a service contact with NASA. Him being a spirit-filled Christian is the one that brings this out. I've never read any secular or space person ever say anything like this. It sounds awfully fishy to me, and it sounds like charismatic enthusiasm. And the problem arose when they were charting back the heavens, and they came up with a missing 23 hours and 20 minutes. And so he says, yeah, that's this day right here, about a whole day. Where's the other 40 minutes? Well, the other 40 minutes is the 10 degrees of the sundial over in Hezekiah, 2 Kings. The only problem with that is that 10 degrees there isn't really 10 degrees on a 360-degree clock. It's 10 steps on a wall, which could have been a couple hours. So, in other words, it all fits together so neat, but there's just a lot of problems with it. Now, if all this is true, that's fine. That's wonderful. There's a confirmation here of the Scripture. But I don't think the Scripture needs to be confirmed, per se. And also, I'm not so sure that the heavenly time clock really stopped, like it says here, in that sense. There's a lot of ways this could have taken place without there being any record left in the solar system. I don't really want to just sound like a doubter, but I've run into numerous things. The Southwest Radio Church is majors in these kind of things. They major in real interesting data, much of it hearsay and very difficult to confirm. We'll run into more of this later in the historical books where there are some other things that people have gotten real excited about. But when you really get down and look at it, there's just a lot of questions to it. Looking at chapter 11, go ahead.
Can you give us the reference to that article?
Well, one article came out of New Wine Magazine. Another article came out of Lakeview Messenger. I just have photocopies here. It's always quoting Harold Hill. He's the one who has gotten this story. And I read a book by him, and he is a real charismatic character with tons of enthusiasm, a lot of zeal. And, maybe this is true. I just question it. I've seen other things like this, and when you get down to the bottom of it, it just turns out to be nothing at all, over-enthusiasm. It's just like I've heard so many things in the Southwest Radio Church, not that I even listen to it very often. I just catch it in the car. you know, every so often, and almost every time. I mean, they're building the temple in Jerusalem. It's all a cover-up job. Nobody has ever been able to confirm that. I mean, there have been people gone over there looking for it, never been able to confirm it. They've gotten into Bible numerics, hot and heavy. They've into many, many things. And as far as the world number system and the 666, and I hear them on that all the time. And, you know, I mean, there's no doubt there's some evidence of that pieces laying around here, but it's just not quite what they make it out to be. Chapter 11. Came to pass when Jabin the king of Hazor, which is north of the waters of Merom, up north of the Sea of Galilee, when Jabin had heard those things, he gathered another group of Canaanites. Verse 4, they went out, and they and all their hosts with them, much people, even as the sand that is upon the seashore in multitude. Now this is really going to be a blessing for Israel. Instead of having to find every one of these enemies and go one by one by one, attack these cities, why, they've all risen up in your life against you, and it's an all-out demonic attack. I think that that can be a blessing for us. If we fight through to the victory, we can wipe out a lot of demons at once, instead of having to take years getting delivered. Now, it seems like they've all risen up at once and attacked us. That means they're all out in the open and exposed. They're manifesting. They're upset. They're attacking. Here the enemy is on the offensive. The battles increase. Chapter 11 appears to be even a greater battle than chapter 10. Chapter 11, God doesn't cause the sun and the moon to stand still. Neither do the hailstones fall. He doesn't always intervene in the same powerful way. But the victory is assured. In chapter 11, they got the victory. The enemy never quits. In fact, he fights harder. Now, as the sand upon the seashore in multitude, that's a hyperbole. The enemies want you to think that there are that many of them. But they're really not that many. That's a little bit exaggerated, don't you think? But the devil, it appears that there's enough demons around here to match the sands and the sea. The Canaanites were more than just numbers. They had chariots. And many commentators think that these chariots had iron scythes fastened to their wheels. And as they drove up and down the battlefield, these wheels with these scythes going around were like lawnmowers. And they were really fearful because they'd run right over you. Now, some commentators say those weren't invented until the time of Cyrus. Others say that they had them at this time, so I don't know. But Israel was afraid of their chariots, because we read that over in Judges. They were afraid of those chariots. With horses and chariots, very many. When all these kings met together, they came and pitched together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. Don't you know they're going to fight against us? Why pick on us? The little church west of Tukwila. Because the demons have something that they're going to do. The Lord said unto Joshua, be not afraid because of them. Tomorrow about this time I will deliver them up all slain before Israel. Thou shalt hew their horses, which is hamstring their horses, and burn their chariots with fire. Now, Rotherham translates it, hamstring the horses. This was done in later times, 2 Samuel 8:4. I know there are horse lovers here that feel like, boy, cruelty to animals. And we're not really looking at it that way in this narrative. I mean, these are not the horses that you grew up with and that you had on the pasture. These horses are war horses that represented the enemy of Israel, and they represent the works of man and the natural implements of war that the enemy uses. So God had them hamstring the horses so that Israel would not rely on the horses instead of God. Fight God's battles with spiritual weapons, not natural weapons. Don't use the world's methods. It's not that God doesn't like horses. There's a spiritual lesson here, so don't take offense at it. Now, the doctrine of God is be not afraid. Be not afraid. That is the doctrine of God. Do you notice that when the Lord speaks, it's positive, uplifting, encouraging, or he's giving direction for the battle? All of this, I can't, maybe it won't work, I wonder if this is the Lord. See, that's all the enemy. This negative, taking away your faith, putting you in fear, bringing doubt in your minds, that is the enemy. Don't listen to that. Verse 8, the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them. No miracles that we read of necessarily. God just routed the demons. They smote them until they left them none remaining. Joshua did unto them as the Lord bade him, hewed their horses, burnt their chariots with fire. Well, don't take souvenirs from the battle. Do you ever notice how the world makes demonic images of the most expensive materials and the most exquisite workmanship? This makes it hard for you to throw it away. You know, it's like that guy down in Texas, was it, that had that $2 million art object. It was demonic, or the Lord told him to get rid of it. It had to be worth $2 million, don't you know? It couldn't just been worth 20 cents. You know, it's easy to throw out junk, but when it's this marble inlaid, gold leaf, you know, Buddha or whatever else, do you know the demons want that? They want the most intricate, antique, expensive demonic objects, because then men practically go through the tribulation trying to throw them away. You know, these museums down here, they're just full of that stuff. Most of that stuff is religious in nature, religious overtones. Well, he threw it away anyway, $2 million. Then there's a big debate in the Christian world as to whether it was the right decision or not. You know, big debate. Well, let me say this. Without judging on that, at least was a pretty strong witness and a testimony to other people whose demonic objects are maybe worth $5, $10, or $15. I mean, that was a real, you know, a real testimony to them. I'm surprised they don't make rock and roll records out of gold so that people never throw them away. Of course, then they never buy them either. So, but they make collectors out of them so that people hang on to them for that reason. Joshua at that time turned back and took Hazor and smote the king thereof with the sword. Hazor was the head of all those kingdoms. They smote all the souls that were therein with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was not any left to breathe. He burnt Hazor with fire. Verse 12, all those cities. As for the cities that stood still in their strength, Israel burned none of them, save Hazor only. That did Joshua burn. Standing still in their strength, most believe this means did not attack, but they stayed neutral. These were still conquered, they just weren't burned. Verse 18, Joshua made war a long time with all those kings. Josephus says 5 years. Most say 7 years. I think 7 years is probably more accurate here. There was not a city that made peace with the children of Israel, save the Hivites, the inhabitants of Gibeon. All other they took in battle. This was of the Lord to harden their hearts, that they should come against Israel in battle, that he might destroy them utterly, and that they might have no favor, but that he might destroy them as the Lord commanded Moses. Now, this is similar to the hardening of Pharaoh's heart. How did God harden their hearts? It is not as the Calvinist describes, where God arbitrarily came down and hardened their hearts that they might go to hell. That's not what happened here. God hardened their hearts through circumstances and situations. In other words, he brought the situation upon them that caused them to manifest what was in them. God hardened their hearts. It was through circumstances and situations. God caused them and provoked them with Israel that they might attack, so that Israel not slaughter unresisting inhabitants. God provoked them to battle so that the idolatry would be rooted out of the land. God provoked them so that they would be judged for their sins and not go unpunished. You can put here Romans 2, 5 to 9. Romans 2, 5 to 9. They refused to make peace. See, they refused to make peace. They had opportunity to make peace. They refused. And so God provoked them that they might attack. And the provoke was Israel in battle and the various events that took place. Verse 22, there was none of the Anakims left in the land of the children of Israel. Only in Gaza, Gath, and Ashdod there remained. The giants, those princely spirits. Now they only remained in those three cities on the coast, which later became principal Philistine cities. And notice Goliath was of Gath. If they just would have destroyed those three cities, there wouldn't have been a Goliath later on in history. Some of our Goliaths are really things that we didn't take care of years ago. And now that demonic problem has reached Goliath size. If Israel would have taken the whole land, there wouldn't have been a Philistine nation to trouble them and bother them. It was things neglected, left undone, that caused them many later problems. Now, I don't know if you can apply that to your life or not, but it shouldn't take a lot of imagination. I'll leave it up to you. Verse 23, Joshua took the whole land. That doesn't mean every enemy was destroyed, but he took the whole land. Israel had dominion over the whole land, but there were individual inheritance left to be, and even whole cities left to be conquered. The land rested from war. The land rested from all-out war nationally. But individually, there's still much to be done. Chapter 13, verse 1 tells us there was yet very much land to be possessed. And it's obviously not a contradiction, but it needs to be harmonized. Chapter 12 is a victory roster of the number of cities that have been conquered. Chapter 12 records 31 by Joshua and 2 by Moses, 33 kings. Let me give you a typological overview of the first 12 chapters. Just some points here along the way. Joshua is a symbolic book. God has selected out of all that was done. There are many battles here that were fought. He selected those battles that would convey typological and practical lessons for all ages. And he gave them battle plans and directed them in those battles, that those lessons be lived out and given as an illustration. The main theme of the book is obtaining experientially what God has promised us. It's more than just getting the promise. They had the promise from the book of Genesis on. God gave it to Abraham. But this book is experientially getting the promise that God has given. Now, this can refer to deliverance. There's a need for deliverance. There's a lot of principles in this book that apply directly to our deliverance that we're now receiving and fighting for. The love relationship with Jesus and moving into that bridal love relationship with Him. Believe me, we thought we loved Him before, but I mean, we're really coming into places in the Spirit. I mean, love places in the Spirit that cause your whole body to go limp. I mean, cause you to just, you know, lay under the overwhelming love. He's moving us into realms of real love. I mean, I am overcome with loves. I mean, there's people experiencing that verse. I mean, they're overcome. They are overcome. There's a lot of other verses in there they're experiencing. I don't even dare quote any of them. But attaining experientially that relationship with the Lord, many principles are right here. Many applications. We have the title deed or the promise now. That is our legal possession, our legal right. But if we are going to possess it, we've got to initiate and cross Jordan. And then initiate and surround Jericho. And initiate and come against these demons. And you begin to take a few steps like that, and pretty soon you'll have the enemy up in a bee's nest attacking you, and the rest will automatically follow, pretty much. I mean, you cross the land and take a few cities, and woof, the demons will be all over you. Now, some have decided, about the middle of chapters 9, 10, and 11, this can't be the Lord. Look at the fruit. Look at the fruit. I mean, we've got demons surrounding us as the sand, as the sea for multitude. That doesn't mean any such thing. All that means is the devil's mad. That means, look at what fruit? The fruit of the devil? Well, that's the wrong fruit to be looking at, to be judging whether it's of God. We know the devil's here, so we're not contesting that. We're not saying that there aren't problems, flesh, imbalances, people doing the wrong thing. Yes, we know that. I know one brother hit a few guardrails, and I ended up talking with him about it. He said, "Well, I feel like I had too much chocolate." And I said, "Yeah, you did. You pigged out." I hope you learned a lesson from that, because you're probably going to get acne if you keep it up, meaning it's going to show in front of everybody. You pigged out. Well, that's no testimony to the move of God. See, that's no testimony. That's just a reproach. And there are victories. See, there are people that have genuine victorious testimonies over the enemy. And just because you're fighting in chapter 11, somebody else is over there in chapter 6 and the walls have just fallen down. They're marching into the city. I mean, they're right in God's will and they're marching through that thing. Somebody else has had the sun and moon stand still. And somebody else is over there belly aching in front of AI. There's people in all different positions. There's some people east of Jordan. There's other people that said, "Would to God we'd never left Egypt," and they're on their way back. That's really the truth. Now, there are principles here in this book that we don't want to forget, and they're obedience and faith. Faith and obedience. Now, there's unity. That was important, but having faith, it was unbelief that kept them out the first time. It's so important to exercise faith. It's so important to believe. And then just to obey, to get in God's will and stay there. Just stay there. Now, God's given a promise to the early church, and they haven't possessed it. The early church under the apostles didn't possess the promise. They possessed a measure of it. They might have been like Abraham. They walked in through the land, but they didn't really live there. They didn't really dwell there. Ended up in Egypt for some time. And as we've come on up through church history, there have been churches, and more have obtained a measure of the promise. lot of churches are wandering in the wilderness. Some churches are back in Egypt. Some have crossed Jordan. Are we persuadable of the promise? We've been praying for the promise. You know, it never ceases to amaze me that people have been in this church all these years, and we've all been praying that God would move us on. Not just praying that we could have a happy church. We've been praying that God would move us on. We have a vision. And so then when He moves us on, it's as though God isn't doing a thing. It's like God has answered our prayer by sending us the devil. That doesn't make any sense to me. I would lose faith in prayer entirely. If I have to believe that we're now under the devil's power, then I lose faith in prayer. I lose faith in all that we've done. I don't believe it. I'm looking at the good testimonies that I'm hearing. Now, getting more specifically as to certain types, Joshua and Caleb were old-timers. They've seen Egypt. They've come through the wilderness. They represent, in this picture, Egypt is a type of the old life. Joshua and Caleb came out of the old life, Egypt, and then they passed through the Red Sea, which can represent baptism and conversion. It can also represent Holy Spirit baptism, since they're baptized in the cloud, which is God's presence. Then they went on to Sinai, which that can represent a Pentecost, because it was 50 days later. They wandered through the wilderness, which is the trials of our Christian life, crossed over Jordan, physical death, entered into the promised land, heaven. That is one complete picture, starting with Joshua and Caleb on through. If we consider the new generation hasn't seen Egypt. They are raised in the wilderness. To them, the wilderness is the old life. Fiery serpents and trials and disobedience and unbelief. That's the old life. But they left the wilderness and crossed Jordan. Jordan now represents water baptism, spirit baptism, salvation, etc. And Canaan represents the spirit-filled life, the Christian spirit-filled life, where there are spiritual battles to be fought, many victories to be gained. So there's really two pictures, depending on who and what. Circumcision, we said, typifies the cutting off of Christ, who was circumcised for the human race. Christ was cut off for the human race. He became the uncleanness. It was cut off. And circumcision points to the cutting off of the old man, the old unclean flesh, being circumcised in your heart and having the law written in your heart, cutting off the sins of the flesh, legally at baptism and experientially in sanctification. Colossians 3:3 talks about us being dead with Christ in baptism. And then verse 5 talks about telling us to mortify our members. Mortify means to kill. Our members. Dead with Christ at baptism is legal. Mortifying our members, verse 5, is experiential. Colossians 3:3 and 3:5. Now you have to make the types fit as they fit. Joshua and Caleb were circumcised before they left Egypt. But that doesn't fit the type. You don't get sanctified before you get saved. So you just don't put that a part of it. That's just not a part of that type. Joshua and Caleb entered Canaan. It's a type of heaven for them. What about all the battles? Those are just not a part of the type. You take what is a part of the type and apply that. The rest of it just falls aside. Now, if you have a problem with that, every type is either incomplete or contains a lot of material that doesn't fit. David is a type of Christ in many ways, but David had aspects of his character and some things in his life that weren't part of the type. The only thing that'll really fulfill the type is Christ himself, and he's the antitype. Everything else is a type in some ways and not in other ways. Now, I've come to my notebook. I've come right up to what's called a quiz. It's the next page in my notebook. I think perhaps I won't give it to you today, but I'll just tell you that it is in my notebook. It's mainly on types in the first 12 chapters. So I'll let that loom ominous over your heads for a day or two and then give it to you here. Chapter 13. Any questions so far? Joshua was old and stricken in years. Well, NAS and Rotherham say old and advanced in days. Old and advanced in days. It doesn't necessarily imply that he was a rickety old man. The Lord said unto him, Thou art old and advanced in days, and there remaineth yet very much land to be possessed. What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to just divide it up and place the responsibility on the individual tribes to go in and inherit the land. Friend, that's you and I. The Lord Jesus has conquered Satan. He's conquered sin. He's conquered the old man, according to Paul. Who shall deliver me from the body of this death? Why, Paul says, I thank God through Jesus Christ. We've been delivered. And Jesus has put the responsibility right on us to go up there in the name of the Lord and possess our inheritance. And we're just not going to be able to give any excuses when we get to heaven as to why we didn't. Because every excuse you can come up with, he's got a verse that he gave you to apply to that particular excuse. Verse 2, this is the land that yet remaineth. Well, the major fortifications were conquered. Enormous battles had been fought and won. It's doubtful that any large resistance could come from the Canaanites at this time. They could not organize any large army and then come against a smaller tribe and defeat them. It's merely pockets and cities of resistance all over the land. And so the individual tribes by themselves and families could defeat them. They no longer needed to be all in one united army at this time. Major fortifications had been defeated. And so in chapters 13 to 17, Joshua cast lots and gave them their land. And all the borders were drawn up, and you'll see in these chapters detailed lists of many, several hundred cities, all by name, identified and, ascribed to one tribe or another. Joshua divided the inheritance before he died. This was very important that it be done under his leadership, because Joshua left no successor. He left no successor other than the Spirit of the Lord and the Levitical priests, the priests and the Levites, to lead them spiritually. Had he not divided the land before he died, perhaps there would have been continual bickering or whatever, I don't know. Of course, Joshua, at this time, had been proven as God's man many times. Verse 6. All the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon, all the Zidonians, them will I drive out from before the children of Israel. Notice, that is a conditional promise. Instead of, I have given you the land, it's, I will drive them out. This is our future as you attack, as you take God's power. As you apply the principles of faith and obedience, God will drive them out. He will just do it. Well, how is he going to do it? He'll just do it. Just trust him to do it. You do what you're supposed to do. And I know marching around Jericho doesn't always look like the shortcut to victory. But it is if God tells you to do it. Chapter 14. I can cover some of these chapters fairly quickly. These are the countries which the children of Israel inherited in the land of Canaan, which Eleazar the priest and Joshua and the heads of the fathers distributed for inheritance to them. Eleazar is mentioned before Joshua here. The sacred before the civil. And Eleazar is mentioned as having given them their inheritance. Also the heads of the fathers. Now there's a sense in which all of these in leadership are working to bring this about. Even though Joshua has distributed it by inheritance, yet they all are working together. They're all working together to bring about their inheritance. Eleazar represents Christ as priest and mediator. We are receiving our inheritance through the mediatorship of Christ, through the work of Christ on Calvary. Joshua represents Christ as the captain of our salvation. And so we're receiving our inheritance as Christ, our conquering commander, goes forward against our enemies and defeats them. We receive our inheritance through both of these, both aspects of Christ. These are two different aspects of Christ that two men are required to fulfill the type in the one Christ. Now, of course, the whole Old Testament, from cities, rocks, landscape, and everything, is needed to fulfill Christ or show forth Christ. Joshua was the first judge. He did judge or act in judgment. Samuel was the last judge. The office of judge was chosen by God. It was not a hereditary position, as was with the priests and with the kings most of the time. Judges were chosen by God. Prophets were chosen by God. Christ combined all of these offices in one. Now, the heads of the tribes in verse 1, they represent the ministers, the co-workers with Joshua. They complete the work that was started by Joshua. They carry it on. Verse 2, the inheritance was chosen by lot. This is an Old Testament custom of casting lots to find the divine wisdom on a certain issue. We read in Proverbs 16:33, says something like, the casting out of the lot has to do with something that the Lord is giving the lot. Proverbs 16:33, you can probably quote it better than I can here. Now, they didn't use the Urim, and God didn't speak directly. They just cast lots. It's kind of like rolling dice over all these cities, and God gave the lot and laid out all the tribes. Now, the Lord commanded that they do it this way. Now, we receive our inheritance by lot according to 2 Peter 1:1 and Ephesians 1:11. 2 Peter 1:1. You'll read in the Greek interlinear, having obtained by lot. And it's talking about our inheritance. 2 Peter 1:1. Ephesians 1:11. In whom also you were assigned by lot. Talking about our inheritance again. So there's an antitype to this casting of lots right there. You only see it in the Greek and in the Hebrew. You don't see it in the King James. Now, every family was given a measure of land, a certain amount of acreage, and these portions were to belong and be passed down from family to family, and they were never to be permanently sold. They would always return at the Jubilee. and so forth. God has designed a system. Now, we notice there was no state ownership here. It was individual ownership. Secondly, there wouldn't be any Rockefellers, because the Jubilee would continue to break up those that were wealthy and return the land back to the original owner. Now, in monopoly, if somebody just gives you all your property back and they have all the money, you're going to lose it all again right away anyway. But this isn't like monopoly, because hardworking individuals who are given their 10 and 20 acres could make a go of life. And they could, just off of the land, prosper, if God's blessing was there, prosper and become wealthy themselves. So they didn't need a lot of money. All they needed was their land and God to bless them. Everybody could prosper in Israel. Verse 4. The children of Joseph were two tribes. Therefore they gave no part unto the Levites in the land, save cities to dwell in. Now Joseph got the birthright. Reuben lost the birthright in 1 Chronicles 5:1. 1 Chronicles 5:1. Reuben was the eldest, but he lost the birthright. Joseph, Jacob's favorite son, got the birthright. Now the birthright was the double portion. And so Joseph's two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, each obtained a full measure, since Joseph had a double portion, and so they became full tribes in Israel, even though they're grandsons of Jacob and not sons. They became full tribes. Now, because Joseph had such an outstanding blessing from God, Ephraim and Manasseh inheriting that blessing, you read about that in Genesis 48. There in Genesis 48, where Jacob blessed Ephraim and Manasseh, pronouncing the firstborn portion and blessing on Ephraim and not Manasseh, who was the eldest, but it came upon Ephraim in the spirit, and God caused Ephraim and Manasseh to be great tribes because of their father, Joseph. Now, there's two ways of reckoning 12 tribes in Israel. See, Levi didn't receive an inheritance here. They received 48 cities instead. And God wanted Levi to be spread out throughout all the tribes, that the Levites and priests who are responsible for the teaching of the law of God, that they would be spread out throughout the land and have an influence on Israel. Now, on the high priest's breastplate, in Exodus 28:21, we have 12 tribes, Levi not mentioned, but Ephraim and Manasseh mentioned. Ephraim and Manasseh mentioned, with Levi being omitted. There's 12 tribes. On his shoulder, in Exodus 28:10, is a second way of counting 12 tribes. This is to count Joseph by name as one, and Levi, just the straight 12 sons of Jacob. That's one way. Or you can omit Levi and count two grandsons and still get 12. They're always reckoned as 12. Both are required to define Israel, and both show forth a different aspect of Israel. We'll talk more about Joseph and Ephraim and Manasseh later. Verse 6. Then the children of Judah came unto Joshua in Gilgal, and Caleb said unto him, Thou knowest the thing that the Lord said unto Moses, the man of God, concerning me and thee in Kadesh Barnea. Caleb and Joshua were the two faithful spies, and Caleb was there at that time. God gave him a promise. 40 years old was I when Moses, the servant of the Lord, sent me from Kadesh to spy out the land. I brought him word again as it was in mine heart. Nevertheless, my brethren that went up with me made the heart of the people melt. Did you notice that fear was contagious? Fear is contagious. Now, people really get on us when we put people out of the church and we say, don't read the newspapers, and they go,
What do you think this is, Soviet Russia?
I say, friend, we're not demanding, as a police state, that people not read the newspapers and watch television. All we're saying is, fear is contagious. Demonic unbelief is contagious. You know what they should have done with those 10 spies that came back with the evil report? They should have quarantined them and not let anybody talk to them. And only had Joshua and Caleb talk to the people and inspired great faith in everyone and gone up and taken the land. Those kind of people influence other people to bad decisions, unbelief, fear, and they hurt the church. And if you ever tried to do anything about it, they think that you're trying to cover up information and hide things back. You know, what are we trying to hide back from people? The cities are walled up to heaven. We can never make it. There's giants up there. We want to hold that back from people. We'll hold back all the demonic circumstances and all the failures. And so-and-so's in trouble, and this person's backsliding, and that person did this. Who wants to hear all that? It's contrary to the Scripture. Whatsoever is true, good, pure, think on these things. Can you imagine if we had a testimony service where only negative and gossip was to be offered from the pulpit? Now, what would be the impact on the service? If only one person got up and did that, you know, everybody out there would probably be praying in tongues that they'd sit down. So how much is it when it's back and forth in the ranks, over the fence and, you know, over the telephone? It has a negative effect on the church. Verse 8, the people's hearts melted. But I wholly followed the Lord my God. Moses swore on that day, saying, the land where you went up to spy out, that's yours. I'm giving you a promise. You're going to have it. You said it was a good land. You're going to get it. Now behold, the Lord hath kept me alive, as he said, 45 years, even since the Lord spake this word unto Moses, while the children of Israel wandered in the wilderness. Now I am 85 years old. I am as strong this day as I was in the day that Moses sent me. Now, therefore, give me this mountain, which is Hebron, whereof the Lord spake in that day. Thou heardest in that day how the Anakims were there. Better be a good place, don't you think, if the giants are there? And that the cities were great and fenced. If so be the Lord will be with me, then I shall be able to drive them out, as the Lord said. Joshua blessed him, gave unto Caleb Hebron for an inheritance. They didn't cast lots for Caleb. He already had his picked out. He picked out some of the best. You know, I like to pick out some of the best. I don't want to just go to the Baptist church. I want the best. And I've always told the Lord, Lord, I don't even want to know about it if I can't have it. Because if I hear about it, it's going to cause a hunger in me. And I'm going to want to experience it. I'm going to want to experience you. Because I have this philosophy that if other people are experiencing you that way, then whatever they did to open themselves up and by faith yield to you to experience that, I can do the same thing. I can have the same relationship. And maybe it took them 40 years. It might take me that long. I don't know. And I'm not saying 40 years of not yielding. I mean, some of these relationships with the Lord, they take a long time to develop. And that's doing everything right. But if God gives me the same time, I'd have that. I want to exert as much faith as I can. And the more testimonies I hear about other people, the more my vision stretches. That's the kind of thing that I would like to hear instead of verse 8. And those people that are out, they think we live in a paranoia in here. Can't even talk to anybody. Can't even talk to anybody. I feel like saying, why would I want to talk to you? Negative, negative, negative. Poison Center USA. Why would I want to talk to you anyway? I mean, it affects you. It's like that cartoon I saw. There's this guy walking down the street, and for a head in the cartoon, he has a garbage can. And there's stuff falling out on the sidewalk, and he says to the guy next to him, I watch TV all the time. It doesn't affect me any. It affects you.